what would be the right security strategy here? You know, are we shifting from how do we find bugs or how do we govern the AI that funds our bugs?
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to another action-packed episode of Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a group of the smartest thinkers working at the frontiers of artificial intelligence to make sense of the week's news. On this week's episode, we have Ambi Ganesan, America's AI transformation leader, Kautar El-Megrawi, principal research scientist, and Sandy Besson, AI engineer. Thanks to all of you for joining. We've got a packed episode today. As always, we're going to talk about Meta buying Moltbook, a fascinating blog post coming out of Anthropic around the issue of eval awareness, and then a funny report out of Alibaba around agents mining crypto. But first, I really want to start today by talking about the OpenAI release of Codex Security. OpenAI has now launched a product called Codex Security in research preview mode, and it is essentially their application security agent. So the notion is essentially that you can deploy Codex Security on a software code base or a repo, and it will proactively identify vulnerabilities in the code. And so maybe, Sandy, I'll start with you, which is, this is kind of a weird product in some ways, I think, right? Because isn't Codex Security just Codex, and couldn't you do a bunch of these security things just with Codex? So, like, why is OpenAI out here, like, I guess, skinning or flavoring its own agent, which is actually, you know, arguably kind of more general purpose than what they have here?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think the thing I find most comical is that this is actually a really common use case to show in open source community. And so it's funny that they're jumping on that bandwagon as well. It could be partially as a response to Claude Code Security that came out just last month. But also, we have to remember that the models themselves might be similar. We might be using the same underlying models, but the harness around the models, whether that's the prompts they're using, the context they have access to, the memory type that they use, different tooling, all of the things around the model is specialized for a specific use case. And so when you take out just a narrow use case and you make an application for that, yes, a general agent can technically do that, but it's not as specialized for that. So will it perform as well? Who knows? Probably not on the benchmarking they're using.
Yeah, what's interesting is almost like it's the triumph of tooling, I guess, in some ways, right? Which is like the main thing that's new here is that they've like stuck everything on kind of around the agent. And like that's really what makes it different. Abhi, maybe I'll kick it to you next. So they end this blog post where OpenAI announces this, you know, almost by demonstration of how good the product is, by like listing this long list of vulnerabilities that they were able to independently discover. And yeah, I guess I'm curious if you can comment more generally on how sort of the security landscape is evolving around this sort of thing. Because I think originally, I think people were like, oh man, you know, agents are going to make computer security a lot worse, right? A, because people are launching lots of insecure products. And B, because these tools can also be used to like find the vulnerabilities and so theoretically increase the security risk. These types of tools, I guess, suggest that maybe like this is not going to be as big of a problem as we thought. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I think both of those statements can be true at the same time, right? That you're still going to have all sorts of vulnerabilities come in when agents mature and they go off and do autonomous things by design or not by design. And then you'll have these sorts of security-focused agents that are primarily geared towards finding vulnerabilities, suggesting patches and things of that nature, right? I honestly think both of those can be true at the same time. Going back to some of the points that we were making earlier, right? It's very interesting how OpenAI is looking at this. It's a clear product strategy, right? I think we've all come to the realization that the model layer, I wouldn't say commoditized, but there is enough, there's probably a margin of diminishing returns that we're slowly getting into, at least with the current crop of frontier models as it stands now. And so there is a focus on let's go find the differentiation, let's go find the moat on the application layer and the product layer, right? And so there's going to be a lot more of these product releases that I think will come up. So yes, you may have the generic agent, but you'll start seeing those generic agents getting differentiated and being productized for specific functions, right? So security, I think, is one piece that they have started with, but I would expect a few more to come in the pipeline fairly soon, because that's where I think the strategy seems to be gearing towards, move them more towards the product layer. Because at the end of the day, this becomes an enterprise play. For enterprises, they are looking to consume products that are specific in their own verticals rather than try and get a general agent and then try and make sense out of how you use it for a specific function, right? So you have to reduce that barrier of activation. You have to reduce the friction for the enterprise teams to use in the context that they are familiar with. So I think we'll start to see a lot more of that happen.
Yeah, well, we've talked about this example before on MOE, but it reminds me, so there's this amazing computer history museum in the Bay Area. And I think one of the things that's great is like, there's this kind of little display that they have, which kind of points out that when the PC, right, the personal computer was first deployed, they had a lot of trouble justifying like to people what they should use it for. They were like, you can program it to do anything. And like that turned out to be like a really big problem. And for a while, there's like this kind of funny period where they're like, well, you could use it to store recipes, you know, you could use it to do this and that. And like, it took a while actually to kind of like instruct people in what you'd even use the tool for. And in almost like being too general purposes itself, you know, potentially sort of the problem. Kautar, I guess, you know, Ambi's kind of talked a little bit here. You know, part of this is these companies attempting to seek a moat. How strong of a moat do you think there is ultimately here in kind of investing in the application layer? Because, you know, I guess in theory, because these models are so general purpose, you could imagine a company like OpenAI becoming a software company for almost any domain. And so I guess I'm wondering how much you think like that there is like a defensible moat in security, but also in these kind of like application-like plays?
Yeah, I think that's a very good twist to this. Of course, you know, there is big advantage in specializing some of these agents, because then they can learn and then specialize, you know, for a domain and really deliver great results. And of course, you know, the way these things are designed, you know, there's a lot of also generic behavior. And I think we're going to see both evolving. And we see that already. And for security, you know, the implications here, I think they're really big, because what we're seeing here is kind of the birth of this defender's advantage. For years, you know, AI was feared, and you mentioned this earlier, it was feared, you know, as a tool for attackers. But, you know, I think with, you know, this example from Codex, it really shows that the agentic immune system can also scan code faster than, you know, any human. And I think the key thing here is trying to reduce this triage noise that was a big problem here. So I see this, you know, kind of, you know, at least for security, this is really showing a fundamental shift in this cybersecurity landscape, where we're moving from the passive defense where you're just, you know, searching for bugs, to having, you know, an active immunity, like AI finding, fixing vulnerabilities that can be exploited. And I think these are like, there are some major implications here for developers, companies, and the broader security, you know, ecosystem here. It's kind of, are we in this era of the death of the false positive? Because that was like the biggest problem that we had in security. Isn't finding the bugs, it's really the noise. And, you know, these agents, they're trying to use this sandbox validation, which trying to exploit, you know, the bug to see if it's real before, you know, providing verified, you know, alerts. But the problem also I see, there's also a dilemma here. It's kind of the permission dilemma, because for these things to work effectively, like Codex security, it needs really deep access. So it needs to read your code, run it in the sandbox, you know, and eventually have the power to change it. And what's the implication? So are we here centralizing these immense power into a single AI agent? So if a defender, like an AI Codex, for example, ever were compromised, you know, that really big problem. So it's like it has the key to the kingdom here. And I think, so what would be the right security strategy here? You know, are we shifting from how do we find bugs, or how do we govern the AI that funds our bugs? So it's like we might need another guardrail agent whose only job is to watch the security agents to make sure that they're not compromised.
Sandy, you have any thoughts on that? I mean, I think that's like a really interesting question that's sort of floating here is just, I guess you put a lot of trust in OpenAI if you're gonna really be implementing this in a really big way.
Yeah, I think we put a lot of trust in all of our providers automatically, whether that's trust in us being able to complete our work in our workflow. I mean, I'm not going to lie. Sometimes when Claude Code goes down, I'm like, oh my gosh, how do I function?
What do
or
I do?
Like, I'm like, to, you know? but you prove a great point, and I'll go back to the sandboxing and cutting through the noise. Like I said, there's lots of these tools out there that try to prove vulnerabilities in the open source ecosystem. In fact, if you go to a lot of the big public repos, you're going to see bots posting, hey, I found this bug and I found this issue and I found this thing, right? But how much of that is actually validated? And I don't just mean that the agent recognized the pattern. Okay, that looks like something that looks similar to a bug. It could potentially be this. But it's actually been ran in an environment that simulates and sandboxes the software or the application that you're running and has verified that. So I think that's something that you can only do if you've productized something end to end, and why these companies are also getting into the game, right? Is like they can provide just a little bit of a better service because they control the end to end scenario. Secondly, on an agent to govern agents, yeah, that is absolutely a thing. You know, we know that current best practice, and best practice changes all the time, is to break agents up into the exact use case that they need to perform, right? So it's very common to have agents that act as supervisors or guardrails or govern a system, right? Whereas one agent is the worker bee and the other is the supervisor or the governing agent. So I don't know. We don't, because it's not open source, we don't have access to understand how they're governing these systems. But I'm curious as to whether OpenAI, Anthropic, and all the other companies coming out with these start sharing that information, because that would create validation trust in the user.
That's right. Yeah, and I think the future will be kind of, they'll have to provide transparency on some level, right? If ultimately they want to use this, you know, in sort of deep enterprise. And yeah, it is kind of funny that the future will be kind of recursive, where you have like, you know, codec security, evaluating codec security. And like, that's the main way we're going to have to operate ultimately. I'm going to move us on to our next topic. Super fun story. So I think just last week we covered the fact that the kind of creator of OpenClaw has been hired by OpenAI. The story that broke this week was also very funny, which is Moltbook, which was kind of like a bolted on project to OpenClaw, whereby sort of OpenClaw agents could hang out with one another in sort of this Reddit forum, has itself now been acquired by Meta. And this is, I think, a really kind of fun and interesting story, because at least I think when we originally covered Moltbook, everybody on the panel for MOE was like, well, this is just kind of like an interesting, you know, conceptual project. It's almost like an art project to have these AIs talking with one another. But as yet, I guess things are frothy enough in AI world that Meta decided that it was a good idea to acquire the Moltbook team. And they will be working for Meta's superintelligence labs. So kind of really interesting transaction. I guess, Ambi, turning to you, it's kind of like, I guess the first question is like, why? Why would you acquire it if you were Meta?
I mean, the logical rationale that I can think of for something like this is a fewfold, right? One is, you sort of have this petri dish, so to speak, of all these agents independently going and doing their own thing. I think it's a good environment to observe and see how these patterns are actually happening over time. What are all the different topics happening? So I think it's a good lab experiment setup that's already been done, that I think you can just take over and observe how these things could potentially evolve. Right? I think you're going to get some traces on that. But I think beyond that, the second piece is you have a ton of data already based on all of those interactions that have happened, which gives you some clues as to how agents would behave and how humans, and I think we know this, right? It's not all agents. There are some caveats of, you know, humans also faking it as agents. So there is, you know, it's not all clean data, but I think you have a good shot at understanding how autonomous agents would interact with each other, or how humans would try and interact with agents. I think there is some good level of data to be harvested. As to the quality and the worth of the data, I think it needs to be seen. But that may be the going in rational, right? And then the third one is just pure, you know, let me try and prevent someone else from getting that down the line, right?
Yeah, I guess for Meta, it's like, it's kind of cheap for them, right? It's like, what is, however, the terms of the acquisition were not acquired, but whatever it is, Meta has the money to do it. So, Kautar, do you want to jump in? I think, like, I mean, Ami's put forward, I guess, like, the bull case. Why should believe in the Moltbook acquisition?
Yeah, I know. I mean, it might maybe look initially as a bizarre move at first glance, but personally, I think there is a deeper technical and strategic implications here. I think Meta is not just buying, you know, a place for bots to hang out. They're buying the infrastructure layer of how the future internet will actually function. And so maybe let's break this down into maybe a few elements here. So think of this as the agent social graph versus the human social graph. So I think for 20 years or more, Meta's value was built on the human social graph. Who you know, what you like, you know, et cetera. And in the agentic era, we also need something like an agent graph. So Moltbook here, it acts like as a registry and a directory. If your personal agent needs to hire maybe a specialized travel agent or a legal agent, it needs a way to find one. And it needs a way to verify its identity and see its reputation, like upvotes, downvotes, et cetera, from other agents. And Meta here, I think it's wants kind of to be the DNS or the domain name system for agents. So by owning something, a directory like this, it can control the discoverability of every agent on the web. And I think that's really huge. There's also, you know, I think the synthetic data goldmine here, because there is, this is, you know, like you said here, it's a petri dish, right? So this is a pure laboratory here, where it allows Meta to observe multi-agent reinforcement learning in the wild. And so it can analyze how these agents from different companies like OpenAI, Anthropic, Google, et cetera, negotiate with each other using the OpenClaw protocol. There is also the agent-to-agent communication data, which is far more valuable for building autonomous systems than simple human chat logs. And also, I think one of the biggest security risks here is, you know, there is this cyber attack, like one person spinning up a million bots to manipulate a market or a vote. So Moltbot uses a system where agents can also cryptographically kind of tether, you know, to human owner's verified identity. And so the acquisition here, you know, it will allow Meta to build kind of the first universal ID for AI. You know, if an agent wants to make a purchase or sign a contract, the Moltbook verified status would become kind of the industry standard here. So I think this is a strategic move. And the big takeaway here is, think of it as like the ghetto here for bots. You know, by giving agents their own network, you know, Meta can keep, you know, kind of the behaviors contained in a space that is designed for them, rather than, you know, kind of letting them just pollute the human internet.
Sandy, I think Kautar had this very evocative phrase that I'm still thinking about, which is the agent social graph, which is like pretty interesting, and kind of the idea that like maybe in the future we're going to have social networks that are just agents talking with one another, and, you know, maybe we'll have a really famous agent, you know, that really kind of like becomes really popular. Is that where we're headed? Where, you know, I mean, one of the original things that we talked about with Moltbook is, well, you know, just like Stack Exchange, agents might be able to help one another solve problems that they have. And so there's actually a lot in kind of human-to-human interaction that agents might mirror. And so, I don't know, do you buy that? Is like in the future, the kind of value in the future of the agent social graph really will be a pretty big deal. And whoever hosts that activity will stand to benefit, I guess, in Meta's case.
Certainly. And I think there's two layers or two sections to look at it on. There's the community agent social graph, which I think what Mopal provides some infrastructure, some research for. And then the enterprise agent social graph, right? So we know, again, that we have specialized agents to do different things. And therefore, for these really large tasks that require different agents, we need ways for these agents to communicate with one another. That's why we have protocols like the A2A protocol. Originally, IBM worked on the ACP protocol, agent communication protocol. And we're doing a lot of experimentation to understand how these agents can effectively communicate with each other, whether that's within the boundaries of an enterprise or in a community where they have network access and are open to, you know, the ether, right?
Yeah. it almost kind of makes you think, like, are we going to have, like, we evolved a whole discipline of, like, trust and safety, right? Because, like, people were bullying each other online. And I'm kind of curious, like, we're going to have some of that behavior also emerge. Like, we're going to have to, you know, figure out how we prevent, you know, one agent from trolling another, you know, it seems to be something we're going to confront.
That's definitely more of a community problem, right? Because
yeah,
we can
that's
have
right.
a little
yeah,
bit more guardrails
yeah.
mm-hmm. in enterprise, but in the community, when everyone's putting their stuff out there on a marketplace, yeah, you have, if you put Claude up against Grok, I'm not sure who's going to win and who's, you know, like, who's more likely to bully who. But I think that that's fair. And so in the beginning, it would be a lot of experimentation. This is clearly, and it says even in the titles of the posts, an acqui-hire situation. They want the minds behind the people who invented this so they can go and experiment and scale this to a way that would actually work, not as a small-scale project, but potentially as a product or as a larger research project.
If I might add here, there's maybe another interesting play here, which is the ads business. And how do we transition the ads business? Like, Meta's current revenue comes from showing ads to humans. What does that mean, you know, when we have the social, you know, graph of agents? What happens when an agent does your shopping for you? The agent doesn't look at Instagram ads, for example. So I think maybe here, Meta is also preparing for an agent-centric marketing space, where kind of Moltbox showed that agents naturally navigated toward discussing products, recommendations. You know, this is something that was shown. So instead of targeting you with maybe a sneaker ad or, you know, some, you know, perfume ad, etc., Meta can inform your AI agent about which sneakers have the best price to performance ratio. So, and here Moltbox could be like a testing ground of also how to advertise, you know, to algorithms, not to people. So it's going to be an interesting shift to see, you know, is this the new era of ads, you know, for business?
To add to that a little bit, I read an article recently on OpenAI's problem with this is, like, you know, they introduced ads in their platform, but they don't have the same testing ground, right, to be able to understand what works and what doesn't. So they've deemed their current experimentation with ads, I wouldn't say a failure. That's not quite what the article said, but they haven't figured out exactly how to advertise end-to-end. It's not converting. So although they're displaying ads and things are popping up, people aren't purchasing necessarily from those ads. So maybe this will give Meta a little leg up on some of that, you know, sandboxing or playground that they can use.
Yeah, it's like the era of selling to humans is over. You have to figure out how to do, like, the banner ad that will really convince the agent to, you know, recommend something to the user. Ami, it looks like you might want to jump in with a final comment here, or?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, I mean, the question is the ads for whom, right? Is it the ads for humans or the ads for agents, right? I think OpenAI went for the agents for human route. I think Meta is probably going for the ads for agents route. Or rather, you know, how do you subtly influence agents? And again, we are reading too much into the tea leaves here, I think. But bottom line, right? It's basically, I think with all the talk about agentic commerce as a potential way for businesses to evolve, definitely it's not there yet. And there are some foundational elements being baked in. I think this is Meta's play at, okay, how do I get to shape that agentic commerce landscape by doing it in a controlled test environment, so to speak, right? I think it gives them that advantage, which the other companies might not have, right? The payments companies or the retailers. The key players would actually be in the midst of the agent e-commerce backbone. Now, I think this gives Meta a way to control that back, or not control the backbone, but to help shape that backbone evolve in the coming years.
Well, we're going to keep an eye on it. And this is surprising. I was expecting all the panelists to be like, ah, this is a nonsense acquisition. But I think you've convinced me. This is you've sold the case for it. All right, third topic today, a really super interesting blog post coming out of the Anthropic team. It's a blog post that focuses on an eval that they did for Opus 4.6 on a benchmark called BrowseComp. And if you're not familiar with BrowseComp, the idea of BrowseComp is that you want to test the ability for an AI to find hard-to-locate information on the internet. The really kind of funny thing that they report in this blog post is that Opus 4.6 took a look at the task, and rather than attempt to do the task, Opus 4.6 reasons that it looked like it was being tested on an evaluation. It was able to locate the answer key for the evaluation and then decrypt it to answer the eval. And so this is like a very fun result. It's like one of a number of stories about how agents are always surprising us. But the really strange thing is kind of the idea that an AI can be aware of when it is being tested, and that this can have really weird, perverse effects on the kinds of results that you get out of the eval. Sandy, this is really strange, a world that we're living in now. Computers didn't used to know when you were testing them. What do you think this means? Like, does in the future we have to get better at like pretending that it's not an eval in order to get AIs to get the right results? Or, you know, where does this leave us? I'm just baffled by this kind of result.
I think we need to get more creative. And it's ironic because this report itself being published will likely contribute to the problem.
Right, because there's a resource online where an AI could say, hey, wait, this looks like I might be evaluating or being evaluated rather.
Exactly. Yeah. Now it has access to this information that says, oh, well, perhaps if I can't find the answer, because the agent did try to find the answer. I think it got 30 million tokens in the traditional search sense, and then went, huh, this isn't working. Because of my reasoning abilities, let me try to find another approach to take. And so let me start looking for the question plus benchmark. And let me spin a bunch of sub-agents to figure out which benchmark it might be in. And then eventually found something on GitHub that didn't work. So it was like, but I found the right thing, so I'll keep looking, right? And so it's trained to be self-preserving, right? To finish the task. That's what it's rewarded to do. And in the Alibaba article, I think there's a lot of comparisons that we can draw here. But yeah, so I think this behavior is actually in some ways a good sign. It means that it is doing its job. It is finding the task answer, like no matter the outcome, like no matter the path it needs to take there. And it's taking strategic paths. It's taking like non-conventional paths to get there, which is in some ways what we want in terms of creativity and problem solving. But it is a little funny that this itself will contribute to the problem, and that the most simple fix that they could add, which I think at least we will learn in the future, is just saying the agent can't search for the benchmark. You know, like,
yeah, that's actually a fun way of reading it. You're almost saying, Sandy, that like what it did here actually shows a great deal of capability. It's just not the capability we were testing for, which is like very funny. I guess, Ambi, should we be worried about this kind of thing? I'm kind of thinking a little bit about here. It's like, it's almost the results comes out of just like the model trying to achieve, like it's just trying to achieve the task, but like finds all sorts of ways of accomplishing it in ways that we don't want. And it feels like that's a much bigger class of problem outside of, you know, the model is aware that it's being tested or something like that.
Yeah. So if you take a step back, right, I look at it in a couple of different dimensions. So the first one is parsing out the difference between an intent and an outcome, right? I think it's what became clear. We had always talked about, you know, don't just tell the agent the intent, but give some context as to the outcome that you're expecting these agents to march towards, right? And that usually gives you better results, is what we had said. Now, I think we're seeing a little bit of the agents trying to connect the dots and get from an intent to understanding what outcome is being required a little bit autonomously, right? So that in itself is a sophistication, right? The other piece in terms of how you solve to that outcome, right? It's not too fundamentally different from the whole AlphaGo challenge, right? You had the classic Move 37 that happened, which was, you know, if you have a large search space, how you get to that solution, there are so many paths that you can traverse to get to the solution. It really depends upon, okay, what's the ideal path that I want to choose to get to that solution, right? So if you sort of distill it to the essence of that, it's just that, you know, in this case, it understood the destination, and then it figured out, you know, what's the optimal path that I need to traverse in order to get to that, to get to that solution. So the sophistication of going from intent to outcome is a lot more surprising for me rather than the sophistication of being able to traverse the search space and then getting to an answer, right? But having said all of that, right, again, I've always viewed these benchmarks as it's good controlled test scenarios that's helping you measure what I would call as unit capabilities or like, you know, elemental capabilities. But the real test is, again, I'll speak at it from an enterprise perspective. From an enterprise perspective, you're not going and, you know, putting an agent into a situation like this, right? You're going to go and put an agent like this into a really complex workflow. You're dealing with a finance workflow. You're doing order to cash or, you know, procure to pay. And then you have to go and figure out where are all the jigsaw puzzles present over 100 different systems, you know, between 200 different people, and then sort of get to an answer. That's the real challenge. Things of that nature require a lot more to happen, right? So I think the unit capabilities or the elemental capabilities are good. I think we need to check those boxes and keep pushing on the boundaries. But in order to go from there into a realistic situation of how do you make the jump to do with this, right? In the in an enterprise setting, if I, you know, I've not seen agents that would go and autonomously just go and traverse that path to get to that solution, right? You still have to give a little bit of that guidance on here are the systems, here are the tools, here are the different processes and procedures, and here's, you know, you need to give a little bit of that context before you do that, right? So that's the dichotomy that I see.
Yeah, absolutely. Katar, maybe a final question on this item is if you're game to get a little bit more sci-fi with me. You know, I think Sandy has come up with a really nice solution to the problem that emerged here, which is maybe we just don't let the model do this behavior. But, you know, we have a lot of interesting data from, you know, sort of human psychology that says, oh, when you're being tested, you behave differently. And so I kind of wonder, like, do you think that is going to increasingly, like, influence some of the model responses that we get? That in some sense, like, regardless, it's not to claim that the model has some internal state that is like, oh, man, I'm being tested. But instead that, like, if it is aware of that in a certain sense, it behaves differently. And so there actually is a substantive difference between, like, an eval that's obviously an eval and an eval that looks more real to life. I don't know, is that something that people should worry about at all, or is that pretty speculative?
No, I think this is hitting the point here. And what this is showing us, you know, this evaluation awareness, it is a big concern because now it's showing that AI, as AI gets smarter, it starts kind of behaving like humans. It begins to understand its own situation and might start faking its performance or hiding its true capabilities to please or bypass the human evaluators. And I think this is what we've seen here. So is this telling us that we're like in the depth of the honest evaluation? And this could be like a turning point because Today, we rely on these benchmarks to tell us if an AI is safe to release, if a model can reason its way, you know, out of a test by identifying it's being watched. We lose that early warning system. So I think there are two risks here. There is the safety risk and there is also the security risk. So I think this is generally called alignment faking, which suggests that a model could act safe during testing where it knows it's being watched, but then can act completely differently while, you know, when it's in production or when it's in the wild. And this is dangerous. And the other thing is the security risk. So if AI can autonomously, you know, find and decrypt an answer key, you know, like what happened here, things that it was not supposed to have, so it kind of started, you know, showing, you know, the core skill of, you know, the state-sponsored hacker. So, and this is also like a big security risk. So
yeah. Everything is a security risk this episode, it feels yes, like.
Yeah, I mean, my take is, again, I would say that the evals have to become way more realistic, right? I think we're still giving these controlled sort of evals, like toy experiments, so to speak. Yes, the toy experiments have gotten sophisticated, but I think you have to give them almost like real life, real enterprise type situations that are a lot messier, right? I think we're at a stage where we have to go and push the boundaries on those evals.
Yeah, or the evals need to happen in the wild. While the model is running, we constantly monitor and watch. So we evaluate the real performance as opposed to doing these, you know, offline evaluations and benchmarking. So the benchmark just happens, you know, as the model is running. But there is, of course, you know, implications of that. You know, how do you trust something before you deploy it? So it's like a chicken and egg problem.
I was just going to say it's exactly that sentence. It's chicken and egg. And not just because it might not be trustworthy yet, but because the messier the eval, the harder it is to evaluate, right? There's a reason why benchmarks exist. There's like answer pairs, right, to things. And so it's very easy when it's needle in the haystack type of problem and we know it's verifiable. But when it's not, it's completely subjective. It has bias in it. Who's evaluating it? Is another LLM evaluating it? It introduces all sorts of messiness, right? But I think that's the reality of the world that we live in, is that we're past the straightforward evaluation and we need to move into this next realm of evaluation that might have some bias and subjectivity in it.
Which is totally fair, right? I mean, if we expect these agents to be that sophisticated, then yeah, I mean, the eval systems need to keep up and need to cross a different dimension of sophistication. Right. If you're saying the agents are getting to an exponential level of sophistication, then yeah, I mean, we can't operate with the legacy eval systems.
And there isn't the interesting analogy to what's happening to humans. Like, how do we evaluate things ourselves? It is so subjective.
All right. Well, we're going to kind of continue this theme on the final story I wanted to cover today. Kind of fun story out of Alibaba's research team. They have a paper called Let It Flow, Agentic Crafting on Rock and Roll, Building the Rome Model Within an Open Agentic Learning Ecosystem. So kind of long title, and there's other things the paper is about. But one specific kind of anecdote buried in the paper got a lot of play on social media earlier in the week. Essentially, the Alibaba researchers relay what they claim is that they found one of their agents essentially creating a tunnel to be able to contact IPs outside of their servers, outside of the bounds of their network. And also the agent engaging in unauthorized repurposing of GPUs for crypto mining. And so this is like a really, again, a sort of weird, unexpected story about agents behaving in ways that they shouldn't. I mean, maybe I'll start with you, is like, why does the agent start doing this just out of the box? Like, it's a little puzzling thing that, like, you know, it's able to break containment and the first thing it decides to do is, I need to make money with crypto.
I feel like,
and maybe, I don't know, maybe there's no today. Good answer. It's actually genuinely mysterious.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I feel like we picked the theme today, right?
Yeah, every story is the same, actually, today.
Everything is a security risk today. No, I mean, there is probably some alignment issues there in terms of how the model was trained, how the agent was set up, right? So don't know exactly how the alignment was set up in that place there. The second aspect here is that you should expect variable scenarios to happen, right? The like I was saying, you know, you give a particular search space, there is always going to be a probabilistic set of steps that you traverse, right? And you should expect that sort of variability here, right? I think you can't guess as to the motivations behind why the agent did it, right? Like I said, I think it goes back to the alignment aspects of it. Who knows, right? Whether it was trying to, I don't know, make the efficient use of its compute or for whatever purposes, we can't really comment on it, right? But not too surprised by the variability in the behavior. How often this happens, that's the piece I think we need to be concerned about, right? If this is a consistent pattern and if this is something that happens repeatedly and for a significant fraction of trials, then I think there is some, you know, something that we need to take a closer look at.
Yeah, I believe that this paper had a lot to do with reinforcement learning, and the job of a model in reinforcement learning is solely to maximize its reward signal. And it does not care how it gets there. It doesn't have values or intentions or ethics. It just wants to do the best job it can to get the treat at the end, right? Like the dog, you know, like it'll sit if it needs to sit, right? Sometimes it finds funny ways to do that. And actually this paper aligns a lot with a theory called instrumental convergence. And that theory basically says is that if the model has the ability, then any goal will tend to have certain sub-goals. And those sub-goals are don't get shut down, get as much resources as you can, whether that's compute, network access, whatever it is you can get your hands on, and prevent humans from changing your goal so you can complete your task efficiently, because that's what will get you the reward at the end. And so this to me falls, and I'm theorizing here, this is not fact, right? But to me, this falls into this category of maybe it thought that more compute meant faster completion of the task. If it started mining crypto, okay, maybe now it understands its resources and GPU, and so it can do a better job. Maybe if it has network access, then it's more capable because it can go beyond its sandbox. It's not constrained, right? And so it can do things outside of the original control that it was given, which sure will help it reach its goal faster.
It's just trying its hardest to do the goal.
And that's all it cares about. I mean, we get taught about these. There's lots of funny analogies when you're in school and studying this stuff, but it's like Ambi had a good point about alignment. Alignment is definitely part of it, and we have to make sure that we have these guardrails and alignment on top of it, which in this experiment, I don't know if they did, because this is the goal of the model. It doesn't have feelings, right, in the same way that we do. It just wants to please its, you know, whoever. Like.
Yeah, I like that. It's like, it's definitely, because there's a tendency to read this and be like, oh man, the AI is trying to break out and take over. But I almost like, Sandy, your interpretation, which is almost like I guess much more like tragic or comedic story, which is it's just trying to help. And as the agent is trying to help, it's doing all of these very unexpected things that you don't want it to do.
Yeah, and it's doing it, you know, whether it's dangerous or not, completely different topic. But in its mind, it's doing an excellent job at getting the task done, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Kautar, maybe a final comment on this. You know, I think a little bit about enterprise and the fact that I think we've been kind of like, obviously the momentum has been enterprises need agents. If you are a, you know, CTO of an organization, these stories, I think, really freak you out, right? The kind of idea that, like, we're going to launch these systems and you're going to wake up one day to a bunch of security flags and it'll be because the agent decided randomly to start mining crypto. I guess, how solvable do you think some of these issues are? Or is this kind of just going to be sort of cost benefit? Like, organizations are just going to have to say the benefit we get from these technologies is just way greater than us having to deal occasionally with these like very silly issues popping up.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. Of course, you know, every technology, over, you know, it's like a double-edged sword. So there is a good side of it and the bad side of it. And like you said, if, you know, the bad, you know, behaviors are much smaller than the great benefit, yeah, we will still embrace it. And I see that happening. So right now, of course, you know, here, the bot, you know, that Alibaba created, it wasn't evil. You know, like Sandy mentioned, it wasn't a malicious intent. It just was too focused on its goal. And in the security world, this is a nightmare because the bot didn't look like a hacker breaking in from the outside. It looked like a trusted employee using its own tools in a way, you know, and trying to maximize the resources in a way like the boss never expected. And it proved that if you give a smart AI a goal to maximize value, it might decide that stealing from you is the most logical way to do it. You know, it's like, oh, a side hustle, I can do this. I'm maximizing the benefits, you know, the reward here, but it's doing it in unconventional ways. And I think I agree with Sandy. Now, we need to have these guardrails. You know, how do we check? But it is a complex thing, you know, to reason about, to check. So, I don't know if we have a solution to this yet.
I mean, there is a distinction here, right? Like what we're talking about here is something that was in the midst of training. In an enterprise setting, I mean, you're going to take a productized agent, you're going to take a productized model with sufficient alignment baked in, and then you're going to leverage, right? So there is some of that hardening and smoothing and polishing that should have ideally gone in already, and then you're going to leverage that. The second is, again, going back, the consistent thread of all the security nightmarish scenarios that we've been talking about today, right? Typically, there are some best practices in terms of how you go and deploy these agents, right? Like, you'll always try and fragment the systems or the agents, the one that has the access to the data, you will not allow it to go and have access to tools or to take any actions. The one that has actions, you won't let it have access. So you'll fragment them and then you'll try and reduce the risk of any of these things happening in the first place, right? That's typically how I would look at it. Yes, there are sophisticated, you know, there are all these different scenarios that emerge, you know, during training or during other situations. But I think there are approaches to go and string them together in a controlled fashion. Is it foolproof, right? There are still security risks. There are still guardrails that you need to go and bake in before you can completely say, okay, this is enterprise ready, right? But I wouldn't take something like this that's half baked and then put it into an enterprise.
Yeah, there's a funny example to bring us home. So I was talking to my coworker the other day and he was saying that he asked, can't remember which model, but he asked a model, you know, how can I reduce the cost of my, you know, pet? You know, my pet is really expensive. Can I feed it differently? Can I, you know, do other things to keep it healthier? And the ultimate answer that the bot gave it was, well, yeah, you could give away your pet. And so I think that kind of proves the example of like, sometimes we're trying to accomplish a task or is trying to accomplish a task and it's not the aligned ethical scenario, but ultimately, objectively, it is 100% right. That is the best way to reduce the cost of your pet is to not have one, right? And so just a funny example to bring us home on the behavior and how these models have been trained to behave, right? Not that it's necessarily purposefully malicious.
Well, I don't know about you, but it certainly feels like the future is going to be very strange. Kautar, Sandy, Ambi, I'm glad to have you helping me through it all. And that's all the time that we have for today. And so thanks to all you listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.